All right. Everyone hear me all right? Perfect. All right. Well, welcome. This is Wired You Shocked, Electrical Safety and Breweries. I'm Drew Rosanova. I work for the Brewers Association in the finance department. This is part of the safety track. Just want to give you a couple of housekeeping items. When this seminar is done, if you could please rate the seminar and the speaker in your CBC app. It really helps us for future years, getting good speakers for you guys. Also, the last 10 minutes are usually reserved for Q&A, but Mr. McCrinnan is going to make it as interactive as possible, so we'll kind of have questions as we go. There's two microphones right here, so if you kind of have a softer voice, please come up. If not, feel free to yell from your area. Other than that, kind of give you some info on it. This is an interactive discussion, including basic misunderstood fundamentals, practical everyday safe work practices, and basics of specialized equipment. Use safety by design to avoid common electrical equipment failure and provide practical human protection by applying regulations and codes. After this, you'll understand why you need an industrial electrician and why a residential electrician is inadequate. Tony McCrimmon is a certified safety professional with Brewery Safety Consulting. He is a member of the BA Safety Subcommittee, and he has 40 years of experience of exposure to safe and unsafe work practices. He's an OSHA outreach trainer, as well as a trainer for hazard communication, forklift and aerial lift, HazWhopper, NFPA 70E electric safety, gas detectors, safety equipment, respirators, and confined spaces. He has background in electrical equipment used in wet locations, such as brewery packaging and process control. His favorite song is Electric Avenue. His favorite band is AC/DC. And I think he goes to sleep in his safety vest at night. So everyone, please join me in welcoming Tony McCrimmon.
Thanks, Drew. For those of you that just walked in, on the back table back here, there's a participant's guide. It includes some information that I'm going to refer to in the slides and definitely has information that you should take home as a reminder of things that you're going to need to ask about, talk to your suppliers about in the future. I just got done doing my quick run around on the floor and was talking to a couple of guys about a couple of things, and one of the things that came up is panel sizing, which is going to be one of the last things we'll talk about, and why we size our panels the way we do to do them properly. And that is one of those examples of something that I see done wrong in so many breweries because of cutting costs and not understanding what happens with how you size panels and things like that. I haven't decided what I want to do when I grow up. Best advice I got from my father, I actually got good advice from my father, was to learn something new every day. So 40 years down the road, I have picked up details across a number of different industries, jobs. I started out in technical support and application and sales of all sorts of equipment for production facilities, which back in the day when I got off my dinosaur and went to work every morning, those variable speed controls were based on a pulley that went in and out with a belt that got longer and shorter depending on which way they... Okay. And then when all the variable speed controls started to come out that were all electronic and PLCs and all this other stuff, I happened to be just smart enough to tag on to that and learn what I needed to know. I have done applications of servo systems in candy packaging factories and had to fight some of those kind of things, including the lack of knowledge that you shouldn't be doing that kind of work wearing a tie. And the only way we did that to do it safely was to tuck the tie inside our shirt and then sit there and do the adjustments and make sure that the line was running properly. Okay? So, been there, done that, have learned a lot. I still, somehow or another, managed to survive, but I don't want everybody else within the brewing industry to end up in that same kind of a situation. And this is why. I don't know how many of you heard about what happened last August in the Charlotte area. And I'll briefly touch on part of what we need to know there based on what little we know at the moment. But we lost a brewer, and since that that story came to light, I've talked to a number of different brewers, including one that had a very similar situation. It was very lucky to be alive, he told me, when he told me his story, he also said that since he had his situation occur, he's had five different brewers come to him and tell him that that has happened to him as well. So we've got an issue out there going on that definitely isn't well known, has caused some potential injuries and definitely a fatality that we need to be aware of. The biggest thing we need to do in this industry is talk, share. On the BA Forum, we're building a lessons learned platform that we need to be sharing these things in. Okay, there's going to be a survey. We're building a professional survey. There's going to be a professional group that's going to actually be managing this survey for us. And as part of this, you may get calls about injuries in your facilities. How many of you have 10 or more employees? I don't need you to put your hand back up again because I don't want to do that and know that. But if you just put your hand up, you know you have to report any injuries that you have, right? Any. Not just the ones you feel like telling people about. Any. So that left half the room that didn't put their hands up. So if we in the Brewers Association Safety Subcommittee are basing the things that we talk about in our presentations on hearsay, is that going to be the best way, or is it going to be documented events and things that people are willing to talk about themselves? It happened to me. Here's what happened. Here's how to fix that and keep that from happening again. We can't rely on the OSHA statistics because, number one, those statistics, they are split up, so construction is separate, right? But the problem is every other industry does not have the same kind of problems that you guys have. Right? The exposures that we have in our factories, because we truly are factories, you know, this is not brewing in the driveway, right? We all understand that. The things that we need to have statistics on, we're not getting from OSHA because it's too watered down by everything else, and also by the fact that if you don't have more than 10 employees, you're not reporting what's going on. And I know there are a lot of people with 10 employees and more that are not reporting either, so that means that we really don't have good statistics. So if you get that phone call, please share. It's really important for us to do this in order to help fix. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to start with the very basics, misunderstood, what happens when somebody gets injured by electrical situations. I'm going to go into some more of the basics of just the standard things that we talk about under code and under OSHA and those kind of things. And I'm going to take this further to get into the more of the safety by design side of things and talk to you about some of the basics of how you choose your electrical panels, how you choose your sensors, how to do things a little bit safer in the builds that you guys do. I'm going to get into that kind of stuff because there ain't one of you that doesn't have a control panel. And I'd be willing to bet if we had a photograph of every control panel from every one of you in this room, that there'd probably be 25% of them that are built undersized, and I'm going to explain why that's important, okay? I just had this discussion down on the floor with one of the guys, and he said, I'm seeing people have this problem all the time too. So this is going to be very basic in some parts of it and pretty advanced in others, but I'm going to try to keep it in that area where everybody gets enough out of the advanced stuff that I'm not trying to make you an expert. I'm trying to give you enough that you understand the questions to ask of your suppliers. You're going to be buying a panel down there this week? Ask this of the people building your panels for you, okay? And I'll also do this from a standpoint of, are we protecting equipment or are we protecting people? Because there's a little trade-off there, right? We have two ways we have to look at this to make this work. OSHA and one of our safety subcommittee members, OSHA is really active in Ohio, and one of our safety committee members is really active in Ohio. And he had a conversation with the OSHA inspector that's in his area, who said, you know, it really bothers me. I go in all these places, and I see all these things, and the one thing that I know everybody doesn't understand is this concept that OSHA can lock your doors just as quickly as the TTB can, okay? They see things that are wrong. They're going to say, man, you can't do this. You've got to fix this before you can do any more work here. I'm trying to help also make sure that that isn't where you guys end up in a situation where, you know, how many of you can afford to shut down for a day, let alone a week or two or three or, right? So, cost of injuries. What are the costs to your business? Production time. How many of you have time you can afford to lose in a week? You know, you could, if you're planning on working, you're planning on working 40 hours this week, is that going to be 2 days or 3 days worth of work, right? Laughing, our group got together, and a couple of the guys, oh, man, I am so exhausted, and I'm so glad to be here because I'm going to get to recover from all the work we had to do to get ready to be here, right? Okay, I get it. What about to the person themselves? You know, and it's not just the medical cost. So like the individual that survived the electrical shock event, third degree burns between in the fleshy tissues between his two shoulders from one side to the other. How do you think that affected his family who had to be there and somebody sat in that chair in the corner while he tried to recover day in, day out for weeks until he was actually allowed to leave the hospital? What kind of an effect on the family, okay? What kind of a well-being do you create with your employees because of the fact they feel safe working in this brew house, okay? There are a lot of people that I've heard stories from that, you know, they go work for somebody for a little while, realize that they're doing really dumb stuff, and they say, you know what? I'm going to find someplace else to work. How do you keep business continuity in those kind of situations? I can't understand how an employer like that can stay in business, right? You just get somebody understanding what your first recipe is, and he's saying, yeah, but I'm out of here. There's a calculator on the OSHA website that talks about the costs of injuries. I threw up, and burn can be electrical burn, or it can be wart in the boot, right? This is the average cost that they've gotten from the statistics that they've run, okay? When you talk about indirect costs are the things that the employers always pay every time, okay? Direct costs are those that are going to be shared based on whatever your copay is, so to speak, with the workman's comp. Because depending on what your coverage is, it's not going to be a full thing. I'm not going to get into the concept of we're using our personal insurance coverage because you should never do that. Do premiums go up when we use this stuff? We shouldn't be doing that to ourselves. If we're a one-person shop, we shouldn't be doing that to ourselves either, right? Do it through the business. Yeah, it's going to affect your bottom line. But, of course, if you're working to keep them from happening, your premiums won't go up, right? So that's where we want to go. Fundamental-wise, current is equal to the volts divided by the resistance. You know, that's that old concept of thinking about the fire hose. You can have 100 pounds of pressure in a fire hose, but if it only flows a gallon per minute of water, it's not going to do much, right? You got 100 gallons per minute at 100 pounds per pressure. Is that going to move some soil? You know, the big river, the flood. What does the valley look like after the big river and the flood? All torn up, right? As compared when there's very little water whether it's flowing fast or slow. Okay? If you look at your motors on your pumps, a lot of these motors that I've seen will actually have double voltages. And you'll notice that your voltages, when the voltage is high, the amperage is lower. Okay? And it does the same amount of work as lower amperage with higher voltage. What's the advantage of having lower current requirement? Smaller lines. Does it lower your costs? Lowers your cost. And if something goes wrong, do you have the potential that less current is available in a circuit? Okay. So in this situation here, at the higher voltage, I've only got a 7-amp requirement. What kind of a breaker can I use on that circuit? A 10. The other one is 14. It's either going to be a 15-amp, which you know as well as I do, that thing is going to trip all the time, right? Or a 20. So if you're going to protect the equipment, because this isn't about protecting people, this is about protecting equipment. If you've got a 10-amp circuit versus a 20-amp circuit, are you going to be able to protect quicker? You are, right? Okay, so that's that aspect of what we want to do with our current. Does a shock damage human cells? Sure it does, right? You're basically cooking it. You're creating heat. You know, wattage? That's how we rate our toaster oven, right? So when we look at, in this chart, I put this chart on the participant's guide so you guys would have it. Refer back to it if you can't quite read what's up here. So the concept is sensation of shock happens somewhere between 2 and 10 milliamp. All right? When does a GFCI go off? So if you go plus or minus 1, it's 5 plus or minus 1, 4 to 6. That's the expectation, but they'll call it out in the specs as 5 milliamps. So if I'm feeling this at 2 milliamps, am I going to get a shock before that GFCI cuts in? Absolutely. And that's why it's so important to have those in place. You go through this concept of what is the body resistance? Well, they've done some testing with live volunteer people who were willing to do this, crazy as it sounds, and they found that under the, let's call it the best circumstances, though that's not the best circumstance, under the best circumstance, the body resistance can be as low as 500 ohms. OSHA quotes that in their letter of interpretation about what the expectations are for voltages that could cause injuries. They've got it on record of injuries at very, very low voltages. 1,000 ohms is pretty consistent, pretty acceptable and expectable. And what the concept is that broken skin provides less resistance. How many of you have dermatitis? Come on, you work in a brewery. You've got broken skin on your fingers, don't you? Less resistance, okay? And the other part of that is voltage as part of a shock event is going to break down your skin, which means it's going to break down that resistance as you're getting shocked, which is why you need to get in into this situation of having your GFCIs come to your aid. This is the letter of interpretation. If you want to actually read the whole thing, I do recommend it because it does talk about the concepts of electrical safety and gives you a real concept of what the view is from OSHA's standpoint when they start to address these things. A switch doesn't kill power in a circuit, right? You always have the potential for the power to be there in that circuit unless both legs of the circuit are disconnected. A switch doesn't disconnect both legs. It only disconnects one. More statistics, just so you've seen them. I don't have this one memorized, how many people are going to die during my presentation today. But today, at least one person is going to be electrocuted in the workplace. So in other words, of us in the room here, we've all come to work today. How many of us, raise your hand if you've planned to not go home today because you died from an electrocution in the brew house today? And that's not the way it works, is it? It's not I plan to have this happen. It's because of these other things that are being ignored. NFPA 70E talks about host and contract employers' responsibilities. When you bring in a contractor to do work in your brewery, you have to provide them certain information, drawings, circuit breaker amperages, things like that related to the circuits, so that these guys can figure out what they need to do to protect themselves. Now, number one, aren't they supposed to be shutting off all that power and locking it out and tagging it out? And then once they do that, what's the next step of all lockout tag out? Verification? How do you verify? With a meter? They go in there with two probes. What happens if the circuits are improperly marked and they shut off the breaker that is supposed to be to motor number one and it's really to motor number two? People die because those probes arc as well. And we've got to protect and provide this information that helps our electricians go home safely as well. I get the question all the time, why is it that our manufacturers don't put the proper tags and information on our panels when we buy them so that these things are properly marked to meet the NFPA 70E requirements? Well, that's because they aren't required to. And depending on what you're doing with that equipment and anything you might add to it over time by putting something else in a panel that maybe that panel is not designed to have other things added to from a heat standpoint, you end up in a situation where those numbers, that information that's on the outside of that panel is incorrect anyway, bless you, and you're in a situation where what you have is you have faulty information on the outside of this, and now your electrician is counting on something that isn't valid. I am responsible for my electrician going home in one piece every day as well, which is another reason why, you know, it was brought up, this idea of using a residential electrician. They don't understand what an industrial electrician has to understand in order to do what we need done out there. Okay? Anybody see what the problem is here? There are a lot of people that don't recognize what that is. So what's happening is one of those legs is broken off for the knife switch, and it's energized right now. This photograph shows you an energized circuit because the disconnect is broken. I'm not showing you this so that you know how to avoid getting hurt here by doing this. I'm showing you how to avoid getting hurt because you shouldn't be doing this, right? This is energized. That could arc or it could electrocute, either way, just depending.
Let's take a look at what happens when an arc doesn't sustain. We have a 30-amp disconnect with the door open here and an arc that is less than one cycle, 6/10 of a calorie. In real time, you don't see much, if any, fire and little or no molten metal. But in slow motion, we're going to get a completely different appreciation for how hazardous this event really is. This disconnect is really no larger than a toaster oven that you'd have at home, and yet in slow motion, you can clearly see how hazardous this event is. The arc flash itself projects over 3 feet, and the molten metal is being thrown 5 and 10 feet in more than sufficient quantity to ignite non-flame-resistant clothing. And again, this is despite the fact that this is a very small piece of equipment and a very brief duration arc.
That's going to leave a mark. So everybody knows that water isn't necessarily all that conductive. It's when you start to add all the impurities into it that it becomes more and more conductive. Same thing with the air. Do we have anything conductive in our air? Occasionally, like when we're running the mill or If you got a conveyor that runs from the mill up to the top, I had to have a discussion with one of the new maltsters. You know, we've got a whole bunch of boutique maltsters now, and they're just starting to get a concept for this kind of stuff too. Famously, somebody's wife went up with their cell phone and was taking pictures through the open top of the silo as the grain was being put into the silo. There's a reason why oil and gas refinery and industry does not allow cell phone use in facilities. It's because they do create an arc and can create an arc that can ignite. And yes, she put herself at risk taking those photographs of that with that cell phone because there was so much dust in the top of that. And I just had to say, man, you know, you don't understand the hazard here and why grain elevators and things like that explode. And it was a revelation for him. He just didn't, and he said he would make sure he had a discussion with his wife. You're going to need to have an industrial electrician because of all the additional codes and things that are necessary for doing the kind of work that we have done, because of the fact that a residential electrician is there. I'm going to tell you, they don't even know what UL 508A is. If you go into just the regular 1910 303 to 399 material in subpart S, everything that's in there is because somebody has died, right? Somebody's shed blood, something's gone wrong. What's the first thing that's the reason why we don't put cords through walls like this, or through doors, or through windows? Yeah, and you end up with them cut, and they're still plugged into the wall. But what's the other problem here? I'm sorry? You can't find it. You're supposed to be within a certain distance for your disconnect of power in an emergency. Where's the disconnect in an emergency? I don't know how many rooms I have to go through and how far down different hallways I have to go to actually find the end of this cord that's plugged into the outlet. That's different perspective, isn't it? When we talk about what we're supposed to do out there, we talk about this idea of having easy access to the disconnects and breakers. How do you like the one on the right? Every time I go there, there's always something there. Why is there always something in front of everybody's breaker panels? Because it's the only spot we got left to put stuff, isn't it? I mean, truly, we don't have enough floor space. You know, I understand that. I get that. How about the one on the left? I'm at the airport buying a bottle of water. There's a transformer. Can you even see the breaker box in the background? There's not supposed to be a single thing in that room with all that stuff stored there. Hazardous locations, we talk about dust. Our dust, for the most part, most of us are not going to have to worry about it from explosive levels, but it definitely is still a combustible material. Okay? A gentleman that was at one of my OSHA outreach refresher classes 2 years ago was telling me that he has had two fires in circuit breaker panels because of dust. And the first one wasn't enough to really wake everybody up to what was going on. And the second one was, and they now have procedures in place that every 90 days, everything's inspected, and now, obviously, everything's going to be dead when you go in there and do this kind of stuff, but they will go in and they'll actually vacuum things out to remove the excess dust because they know that's a potential problem. The other potential problem there is the fact that dust creates a thermal barrier. If you heat up electrical equipment, does it start to break down internally? So if you keep the dust off stuff, all of your stuff is going to last longer. And for the free vacuum time that it takes to dust off the outside of this motor, if you got another 2 months, 4 months, 6 months, 2 years life out of that motor because it's able to cool properly, is that an advantage? That's right off your profit, isn't it? Okay? I'm good with things that save me money. How do you like the way they're ventilating this location? Would have been better if somebody ever checked to see if the vent is actually connected to what it's supposed to be sucking the dust away from. In this case, obviously, it's not. So dust buildup then causes things to overheat, and actually Class 2 equipment is required to compensate for that, which is why we have to get into Class 2 equipment. What's right about this? It's an enclosed switch, but it's also a wet area enclosed switch, which is different than, and I'll show you an example of what it's supposed to look like if it's explosion proof. If this was being used in a wet area, what's wrong? Your grommets are up, so where's your water going to pool? Okay. And then how about this cord? Exactly. You're supposed to have the entire cord surrounded by what is an abrasion protective jacket. It's not the insulators themselves or the conductors themselves and those insulations that we're worried about here. It's being able to protect these from all the cuts, scrapes, scratches. You never want to have flat cords anywhere. Just get them out of your building. They cut way too easily, and they just cause you problems. Okay? So we need to have the correct equipment for the job. We need to have the stuff put together properly. I'll give the people credit. Most of the time when I see these things, there are only two visible conductors, which means there's not a ground in place, right? So you got to give some credit for the fact that we do have a ground in place. The problem is it's still the wrong cord. The longer the cords are, the less current that they can carry, right? The bigger they are around, the more current that they can carry. So they're, you know, if you want to think of it this way, think of it as the bigger and fatter they are, the more we can flow through them, just like the fire hose, right? Do you like that idea? I don't like extension cords, to be honest with you. They're too big a fire hazard and too big a shock hazard. Every power tool that we buy has a chart similar to this in it. And I don't know, I found out yesterday at the boot camp that I'm one of the few people that doesn't. The first thing that happens is I pull everything out of the box with the new tool and I throw away the instructions. It seems like I'm one of those few geeks that goes through and actually reads all of the safety alerts and warnings that's in everything. It takes a few minutes, and you, over time, become really aware and have a huge understanding of what the reasons are for all this stuff. If you look at the outside of the jacket, the outside of the jacket is going to tell you what kind of cord you have. How many of you are using cords that on the jacket it says it's a W cord? Okay, that's good. Check that. That's really straightforward. That's an easy fix. Yeah, they're more expensive, but there's a reason for it. Those things are built and designed with materials that keep water out. And you don't have that when you're talking about something that you're going to use in your living room. Are you concerned about water intrusion? Not me. I don't have too much water in my living room, except when we're having a big party. I'm sorry? I don't want to get into all the other stuff. If you get into the charts, this is just the quickie of the chart. There are other charts that will give you the other information. And if I think I know what you're talking about, I think you're talking about the gauge size, which would be diameter of the conductor itself, but we can talk offline. Good question, though, and please ask questions. I may defer till later, or I may defer to another slide down the road. There's my first tip. Never use extension cords. If you use extension cords, please unplug them from the wall before you do anything else, because if you don't, your extension cord is live, and if you unplug a tool or a piece of equipment from the extension cord, can it arc? So when I heard about the situation in Charlotte last year, my first thought was, because I heard they'd found him on the floor with burns on both hands. My first thought was, is he was disconnecting one of our typical portable transfer pumps and had just not disconnected the extension cord from the wall, and so it arced in his hands across through him. That was what my first thought was. So because of that, I went out and saw a bunch of my buddies and was taking pictures of all their different pump setups. Another thing that I was thinking about is the fact that those variable speed controls have some incredible capacitors in them that have the ability to store up a huge charge and discharge it. That's part of how variable speed controls work. And that was my other thought. How I got started. My dad was with one of the first companies in the U.S. that made those things. So I said, okay, here's what we think's going on. Here's what I think's going on. What can you tell me about that? And he went right to the capacitor, just like I kind of figured he did, was going to. And so I was telling the story about what had happened in Charlotte and what my theory was. And at that point, I had four guys out of 10 tell me that they had the same thing happen to them. And I said, okay, stop just disconnecting your cord from your extension cord. Go to the wall and get that out first and take care of that. And it was, is that simple? Some of these hazard controls that we have are just basically doing things in a way that we're told is the way to keep us from getting hurt. It's not necessarily going and getting PPE or re-engineering the world, right? If the cords are getting hot, if things are getting warm, anything, and it will, there are times that you'll find that the wall outlet plates are warm. Stop using that outlet, get an electrician in to do some repair work for you. There's something wrong there, okay? There's an example of one that happened on one of the work sites I was on. The cord actually started to melt. I've seen a bunch of that kind of stuff. There's a situation that occurs out in the real world that's called inductive coupling. And what happens is if you have power going through that cord, it goes around like that's a racetrack and keeps going faster and faster, and the current gets induced across all the wires, and you do it long enough and you'll end up with a fire. Unused cords, get them unplugged. Make sure that you're pulling on the plug, not on the cord. All those simple kind of things, right? But we can't just take it for granted that everybody has been taught this at some time in their life. We need to have these kind of discussions just to make sure everybody's on the same page. Right? Ultimately, if you're doing it properly, then you don't end up in a situation where you've got a cord in the wall and something else that you're unplugging from that cord and you get an arc across. Okay? These things are called relocatable power taps, if you look them up under OSHA regs. And the issue with these things is people are trying to plug too much equipment into something that is not designed and engineered to have much power go through it at all. Okay? These are basically intended for your laptop and your printer, and that's about it. And it's also expected and is in the reg for just this reason, that those things are to be unplugged every day. They're not to be left in all the time. They're temporary. When we get into GFCIs, GFCIs have been around for a while. A lot of people will tell you, man, these things just don't work all the time. I've been on job sites where the guys stop using their GFCIs and I find them in the trash. Oh, the thing didn't work. I kept tripping. Oh, crap, you know, that stuff. Well, anytime a GFCI trips, it's because something's wrong in the circuit. The amount of them that just fail because they just fail is like minuscule. What these things are, and we'll get into this idea of the difference between a breaker and a GFCI, these are things that actually measure voltages at a very low level, currents at a very low level, and what they do is they measure the outbound versus the return current. And if it's more than 5 milliamp, it trips. So how many of the tools that these guys were using were what the problem was? Or the other thing that I see a lot of people doing is they string extension cord to extension cord to extension cord. Every time you get a plug in your circuit, do you get increased resistance? Which you have to overpower, which is going to be a problem then that this thing's going to measure. Okay? The further out you get, the more change, the more loss in current you have. So you get these problems going on. You get an overcurrent protection trip with a circuit breaker, and then what you're dealing with is you're dealing with those high amperages. So your GFCI is to protect you. Overcurrent protection device is to protect the breaker. Must be beer time over there. And so this is our number then for what we're going to have happen when we have the GFCI break. Okay? Will you get a shock? Yeah. I'm going to get a shock at 2 milliamps. I'm going to feel that. And then at 5, it's going to shut off. Could it get really, really high, higher than 5 before it actually shuts off? It could, because in that first one, and what it does, sorry, I got a slide out of place. These things are to be tested and documented how often? No more than every 30 days. And the reason why is because you need to make sure that they're working. What you're actually doing when you press those buttons is you're dumping power to your ground so that it says, I don't have enough current coming back, and the little current transducer says, I'm getting too big a variation here, I'm going to trip, and it trips. Okay? Here's what's important about this whole idea is it's going to give you a cycle and a half of power before it says, wow, there's a big difference here, I got to shut off. The reason why it does that is because if it went less than a cycle and a half, you would have false trips, and these things just don't work. Okay? But it gives you enough time to make sure that what you've got is a true problem. Okay? Which means that during that 40th of a second, you are exposed to a very high level. So these are not the answer to keep you from being electrocuted or shocked. What this does is this shuts off the power at a point before, if you're grabbing something and you're in that freeze by paralysis, electrical paralysis situation, that you're not in that point where it stays with you frozen to that and you can't let go, because the power will go off and then you break free. So that's where it really pays for itself, okay? It's going to protect your tools and equipment as well, though. Well, for perspective, yeah, because any time it would get too big a surge, that's going to give you what we would consider then to be a false trip, which means it's going to shut off power to a refrigerator. Yeah. And actually, that's right now with this new, there's the new what's called an arc fault current interrupter, which is for arc faults, which would be the blast that you saw out of the box. To protect from those, the new arc arc fault circuit interrupters, most of those things also have a GFCI on them. And there's discussion going on whether that should be eliminated and they should be separated away from being able to GFCI interrupt versus arc fault interrupt. So you're right. Don't put them on refrigerators, because that inrush is going to cause a drop in current on the return leg that's going to make them trip. And if you're trying to protect your yeast, that's not going to help your yeast, right? This is the one where he says, have a brood, don't cost nothing. I love things that are free. Closing panels, cleaning the dust out, minimizing extension cords, squeegeeing floors. Oh, wow, you mean if I squeegee my floors and minimize the water, I have less chance to have an issue with electricity and water? Hey, that's easy. Dust off the electrical equipment. What's the problem here? Why do you think the doors are open? Good thought, but actually, in this case, it's because all of the adjustments are inside. The panel on the left is poorly designed. Everything that you've got to adjust in order to have all the pieces of equipment sync up for the feed into the bottling and then the outfeeding away from is inside. The one on the left, or the one on the right, the only thing they had to adjust there is on the outside. Better? Okay. This talks about that idea of the dust. Before you do anything here, you're going to clean this up. Now, actually, in this case, they've got more issues than just dust. There's a reason why they got dust on their electrical, right? That just doesn't cut it. I do have a photograph from a friend of mine's brewery where he never closed the door on the panel, on the circuit breaker panel. I just can't find it to show it to you, which is probably a good thing. He is still a friend. But the whole thing was just covered with lint. Covered with lint. And you know that's a huge fire hazard, isn't it? How about splash guards? Do splash guards help you with water and electrical? And it also gives you a machine guard too, right? Because you're never supposed to be able to get into any of those inrushing nip points, right? Where you could get pulled into a conveyor, okay? So safety by design. A great way to do outlets in places where you would like them to be, but you have no way to run conduit, like on the floor. There's no reason why you can't hang stuff from the ceiling. If you do, a couple of these are done right and a couple are done wrong. Support the entire length of cord all the way down to the plug end itself. Don't let the cord support itself, because it'll slowly stretch itself out. And of course, that changes the diameters of the wires inside, which will cause hot spots, which increase the change in the consistency of thermoplastic insulation. Do I need to go further there? Don't do it this way, but consider doing them. The plugs that you see, those plugs are actually waterproof plugs. You can see on the pump motor, you see the waterproof plug on the pump motor. If you've got cords, one of the guys out in Colorado has got pump cords that he had when he had these things built for him. He had them built with the cords somewhere in the neighborhood of 50 to 60 feet long, so that he could get as far away from where he was actually doing his transfer work as possible. Okay, and in his new brewery, it's a good thing that he did that, because he's also found out that he only put in one outlet for his 208 powered pump motors, and now that he's had a little bit more growth, he has situations where he's got to run two transfer pumps at the same time. He's got one outlet. Okay, so how do you get around that? Don't do it temporary, right? Call in the electrician, Get it put where it needs to be so that everything's done properly. Be aware that there is what's called an inverter duty motor. It's for your variable speed controls. Those things are built to handle the abuse that a VFD gives to motors. It's huge what you can do to screw up motors. There's an example of dust on the outside of a motor that's going to cause that motor to overheat. Unfortunately, that's an electric heater that also is just covered with dust. What kind of connections do you have on the bottom side? Are they explosion-proof or watertight? In this case, they only need to be watertight, right? Because this is just on the brew house, right? On the brew stand. So here's the concern that we've talked about now yesterday and today with this concept of what's going on with these solenoids that is causing, it has something to do the way I get what little information I can get out of it, and it, you can find this on the OSHA website under the incident because the brewery involved is named. Anyway, you can go in and see, and it says, it talks about equipment grounding was an issue in this. I think that either it's the quick connectors on the solenoids or it's the way the solenoids were wired, that they weren't wired properly and the connections got loose. But at this point, my industrial electrician, we've got a great homebrew club that my group has come out of. We've got industrial electricians and everything else under the sun in ours. And one of mine is a theoretical industrial electrician master. And we were going through this thing for about 2 hours on the phone the other night after I got some more details. And he said that none of this stuff adds up 2 + 2 = 4. And when you've got a theoretical electrician that talks like that, you know you've got a problem that we've got to figure out what's going on. If you guys hear of anything going wrong with solenoids. Well, what's happening is something's going wrong with the solenoid and how it's wired in such a way that it's energizing the fermenter itself. Yeah, not good. In a couple of cases, the stories that I've heard were not metal piping, and in a couple of the other ones, it was metal piping. So it was, because some of the glycol systems now are being done with, PEX? Yeah. So I've heard the story both ways. I would think that we'd be better off with metal pipe potentially taking something to ground a different direction, but that's not what happened. So in one case, so I can't give you all the details of the fatality because I can't get all of those, but in the other case, the situation was the guy was reaching back between two fermenters to grab something that was on the ground between the two and came in contact shoulder to shoulder from the energized fermenter to the non-energized, and it arced across his body. He became the path of least resistance. Not that it's become a capacitor, it's just that it's live. And so now, it's become a conductor, and an uninsulated conductor, and now you become the path to ground. So you become a conductor as well. Yeah. Good question. I'm sorry. That's one of those definitions I probably should have talked about earlier. So emergency motor shutoffs have to be within sight. OSHA has a definition of that. Can you see a disconnect? Can you see a disconnect that is so far off the ground and so far buried behind equipment that you can't get to it if you need to? I don't know how that passed the initial codes when that was built, but it's still there, still functioning. That's been there for 13 years. I told you about the one where Wayne has got the 208 in the background. You can see way back in there, now that he's grown as much as he's grown, his floor space is completely covered with stuff. Okay, and so he can't get to his connections, basically. This all wraps up with the things that are on your participant guide. The ingress protection chart is there, how we decide whether or not these things are safe to use in water. We talk about explosion proof. Explosion proof means that the gases escape and cool as they escape. This is not completely enclosed. Explosion proof allows these gases, internal and in explosion, within this equipment to get out and cool so that it doesn't ignite the atmosphere outside. That's not what watertight is, right? Hazardous locations, we talk about class 2, group G is for grain dust. So if you're going to do that, you need to have group G equipment. Here's your NEMA enclosure ratings. And I included the IEC alongside because that compares the NEMA to the IEC. We had a situation, somebody was trying to build a new brew house, and they were having problems with both the fire inspector and the city electrical inspector about whether or not their equipment was wet area, damp area, or hose it down area. And ultimately, I sent off that chart, and that was what she used as part of the explanation to the electrical group that this was going to be acceptable. Well, if you've got a situation where you don't have, I would say always go NEMA 4, NEMA 4X. Yeah, it's going to be expensive, but NEMA 4X is corrosion resistant besides. Do you want your panels to last the entire lifetime of you working in your brewery? Sure, spend a little bit more money on that. And I know that becomes that, oh my God, how much more am I going to spend? But at some point, you're going to have to spend it anyway. If this stuff corrodes away, you got to do that. There are all sorts of types of motors. Washdown duty is not waterproof. They have little weep holes in the bottom for internal condensation to drip and drain out. And if you get water splashed up in there, you're going to be like Tony Simmons was. And he said, oh, I felt that. And this is the UL 508 part of it. UL 508 is written to keep things separate so that things do not overheat other parts and pieces. See, the panel on the left is the one that I found open because it overheats all the time. The one on the right has the same amount of equipment in it, back in the back here, has the same amount of equipment in it generating the same amount of heat. You notice that panel is what? Twice or more bigger than the other one? It's because all this stuff induces heat, creates heat, and over time, it will share that heat to other stuff. So you've got to have space in there. You know, it's no different than if we get in that crowded bus, you know, to go to that pizza and beer party tonight out at tailgate, and we're all crowded in like this. At some point, everybody's going to be hot and uncomfortable. That's what's happening in these boxes. That's why UL 508 is written. I don't want you to be experts on it. I want you to understand it. And over time, connections that are not properly connected do come loose. So you are going to have your industrial electrician do some work to check your connections. If he can go in and do it with an IR gun, an IR camera, you're better off. But just going in and retorquing the connections on the bus bars and things, it's important. Yes. Okay. So is there anybody that's got any questions? I know we kind of, we pushed it right to the limit. Yes.
You mentioned things like refrigerators on not being on GFCI circuits.
Right.
Is there any kind of protection you would recommend putting on something like that beyond the circuit breaker stuff?
You don't need anything more than a circuit breaker on that kind of stuff because you're only protecting the equipment, not you, right? Okay. If you guys want to take questions out into the hall, too, or out into the hallway, I'm willing to do that as well, because I know we're running. We've probably got a speaker outside that's ready to kill me. Thanks, guys. Thanks for coming. Thank you. Oh, by the way, please make sure that you send off any comments, suggestions. My address and, of course, the BA Forum address is on the participants guide. Any feedback, any questions you have, anything else you'd like to see us do with this material, please share. Thanks.
Thank you.
Open house is tonight at 4.
Cool.
Technical subcommittees, all of them will be at 4 o'clock tonight. Thanks.